Coming up on Travel with Rick Steves, we'll check in with the author of such provocative titles as The Sex Lives of Cannibals, Getting Stoned with Savages, and Headhunters on My Doorstep. That's J. Martin Troost. Plus, we get a first-person report on a visit to Papua New Guinea in just a bit. Right now, joining us from Sydney, Australia, our guest is Ian McCallman. He's a social scientist, explorer, historian, and a professor of history at the University of Sydney. His books include Darwin's Armada, The Last Alchemist, and Radical Underworld. His latest is The Reef, a passionate history of the Great Barrier Reef from Captain Cook to climate change. Our phone number is 877-333-7425. And Beverly's calling in from Stone Mountain in Georgia. Hi, Beverly.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have visited the Great Barrier Reef along with my husband in 2009, and it was the most fantastic sight that I know I've certainly seen underwater, and one of the top sights anywhere. Beautiful.
What is special about the Great Barrier Reef from a wide-eyed snorkeler's point of view?
What's so very special is the quantity of the coral and the quantity of the beautiful fish that you see. We were on a full day snorkel where we went out several miles from the coastline before we got to the reefs, and it was amazing because of the sheer enormity of both the reef corals and the fish themselves.
How was the visibility?
The visibility was fantastic. We had a beautiful sunny day. And we were very fortunate to be able to see a great deal. My husband had an underwater camera, and we took some absolutely beautiful photographs that I have in a collage sitting in a picture frame by our kitchen table, which we're able to enjoy every time we sit down to eat.
That's a beautiful memory.
It brings back wonderful memories.
Beverly, how did you get there for people who are sort of enchanted by this idea of snorkeling in the Great Barrier Reef? Is there one particular place you fly to that's best known for its snorkeling?
We actually stayed in Cairns, and then we took a bus basically from the tour company to get to Port Douglas, from which we started our snorkeling adventure.
Okay. Hey, Ian, can you kind of get us the bearings if we're tourists or travelers going down there to enjoy the reef? What is the, if we're not, you know, scientists or helping out with a BBC documentary, if we're just typical travelers, how do you get there and what's accessible?
Well, you fly into Cairns, and Cairns now connects with major USA towns and cities. I think you can fly directly from LA to Cairns. Mm-hmm. You can fly from San Francisco, and it's about a 13-hour flight probably.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a great international airport there. And Cairns itself is the kind of place from which you launch, like Beverly. Some people stay there, but many people stay at resorts.
Do you go in by ferry, or do you fly into little strips, airstrips deep into the reef?
You go out by ferry or by boat. I mean, some parts the reef is quite close to the land, or you can go to an island where your reef, a fringing reef, will be just outside your door.
Nice.
If you, say, stay at one of the resorts, and there are many island resorts. Or you can go out to the very outer reef, which in some cases it could be, you know, 40 kilometers in a fast, big fast boat.
From a traveler's point of view, Ian, you've seen a lot of the reef. What would be the single place to go if you wanted to just enjoy the reef in many different dimensions of it?
Well, I think actually what Beverly did was pretty sensible. A place like Port Douglas, which is also a favorite place of Bill Clinton, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Port Douglas, it gives you access to two of the reef's great things. One is the reef itself, the underwater reef, and you can go out to, say, Agincourt Reef, which is one of the outer barrier reefs. And I remember swimming there just a year or so ago with turtles. It was just fantastic.
Nice.
But at the same time, you're just next to the Mossman Gorge, and it's one thing we haven't mentioned. The reef is surrounded by some of the most sublime rainforest in the world. It's the oldest rainforest. It goes back 46 million years. It's a rainforest that belongs to the time when Australia was part of Gondwana land.
Beverly, thanks for your call.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah.
Enjoyed it.
Ian McCallman is with us right now on Travel with Rick Steves as we learn about the wonders of the Great Barrier Reef. He was born in Africa, schooled in Zimbabwe and Australia, and today he teaches history at the University of Sydney. Ian is also a co-director of the Sydney Environment Institute and a member of the Royal Historical Society. He's joining us now to talk about his latest book, The Reef, A Passionate History of the Great Barrier Reef from Captain Cook to Climate Change. Ian, speaking of passion, you know and love the reef, and it is not a certainty that it'll be here in the future. You call it a fragile and threatened treasure. How so?
Yeah, it is, Rick. It's deeply threatened from so many directions. I mean, all reefs for a long time have been threatened, of course, by the advance of, you know, of tourism and cities and everything else that brings sewage and they bring pollution very often. That has been a factor in the damage to the reef. But the real problem now is as a result of climate change. The reef is affected by climate change in three ways. One, by the warming of the waters. They only need to warm within a degree or two to have reached the limit of the tolerance of reefs, and then they bleach. So there's massive areas of the reef that are now just bleached and dead like skeletons.
That sounds like there's no debate about it. I mean, it bleaches when the water heats up, and there are vast expanses of the reef that are bleached out now.
That's right. And that's true, of course, of every reef in the world.
It's kind of like a canary in the mine shaft when you think about humanity being threatened by climate change.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's threatened in one other way, which is even more frightening, and that is because the seas are absorbing CO2 and methane. They're becoming more acid. And when they reach a certain acidic point, they need to dissolve limestone in order to balance their pH, like when we get indigestion, you know, take one of those tablets.
So the reef is functioning as an indigestion tablet for the ocean?
Yeah, it's got, or you could put it another way and say it's got osteoporosis.
Oh, no.
Essentially what's happening is the water is so acid that it's starting to dissolve the reef. You know, gradually anything that are made of calcium, including little tiny plankton, will be dissolved by these acid waters. So the reef is, again, as you rightly said, it's a canary for much larger and threatening problems, because things like the plankton are at the bottom of the food chain of the whole oceans.
Now, what if we're concerned about that and we want to enjoy and marvel at the reef, but we don't want to contribute to the whole problem threatening the reef? Do you see tourism and travelers coming to the reef as necessarily a problem?
No, I don't actually. I'm in favor of tourism. I think that tourism is one of the things properly managed, tourism is one of the things that protects the reef, to be honest. I think that because of my concern about human attitudes to it, it's tourists like Beverly, we just heard, who love the experience and love the reef, that help us to protect it against people who were quite recklessly willing to exploit it.
Or I suppose it's people like Beverly who go to visit the reef and then can see just physically what's the consequence of global warming and rising sea levels and the change of the environment in sensitive areas that are that frightening canary in the mine shaft, and then they can go home and exercise the political will it takes to take global climate change seriously.
Absolutely, Rick. Absolutely.
That could be the most important souvenir of a trip to the Great Reef.
I think it would be, honestly. And I think we need Americans. You know, I see the reef as a global thing. It belongs to the world.
In America, it's expensive to deal honestly with climate change. And there's a lot of people that, I think, let their judgment be clouded because it's expensive for their businesses to deal with it honestly. In Australia, is there the same dynamic going on? Are people wrestling with, well, it's expensive, so I don't want to believe in it? Or is Australia a land that is more closer to nature and more honest about grappling with something that essentially all scientists agree is happening?
I wish we were honest, but no, I would say that we're probably worse than the United States in our responses. We're desperately frightened of unemployment, and we see mining as the only source of industry and economy in this country.
We are in one tough bind, Ian. All right, well, I don't want to close on a negative. Let's just, if I had a vacation and I'm heading down to Australia and I've got some time to enjoy the reef, give me one vignette where I'll be so thankful that I went all the way down under to check that out. Where would I go and what would I do to make sure I get the most magical Great Barrier Reef experience?
Well, I would, to get a magical Great Barrier Reef experience, I would probably actually go to one of the islands, like Heron Island, because you can step out of your door straight onto a glorious fringing reef and swim around there freely without any fear and with this wonderful environment. And the island itself is romantic and, you know, white sands and so on. I would, however, also make a visit to the mainland to see the rainforests.
That's good advice. Ian McCallman, thank you so much for the work you've put into the reef, passionate history, and raising awareness of this natural wonder that we should all treasure, just like we treasure our national parks here in the United States of America.
Thanks so much, Rick, and thank you for helping me to do that.
Best wishes.
From the tiny microscopic algae to the giant great white shark, dolphins stop by.
Travel just a little north of the Great Barrier Reef and you'll find yourself in one of the world's least explored nations, Papua New Guinea. It's been independent from Australia since 1975. As a member of the Commonwealth, they honor the British monarch as their head of state. Mining for gold, copper, and oil have recently brought some economic growth to the country, but most of its residents still live in traditional rural villages, and many of them are in extreme poverty. There are more than 800 different indigenous communities in Papua New Guinea, and viewing their customs is a major attraction for tourists. Jake Warga got a chance to visit Papua New Guinea, and he files this report for us on what he observed.
Sometimes, one of the hardest things a traveler has to navigate is the gap between expectation and reality. That is, the idea of the place and the often conflicting reality of it. Few places are more exotic in the imagination than Papua New Guinea. It should be like entering a National Geographic cover story with exotic deadly animals and, of course, cannibals. But once I stepped off the Air New Guinea jet, I entered a huge gap, a gap between the past and the present. The Sepik River Basin, deep in the heart of the country, is a popular tourist destination. It's a real jungle river tour with dense greenery, massive birds, and stops at tribal villages to meet the locals.
Okay, my name is Ambrose Otto. I'm from Imas Village.
Ambrose is the leader of Imas Village along the banks of the Sepik River. But there are two Imas villages.
This is Imas number one, the traditional Imas one.
There's the village where most people live, in the present, but we're in the traditional village, the one living in the past where tourists go. They perform dances, supposedly, like they did before outsiders came. I know where Papua New Guinea is, but I'm not sure when it is.
But we must totally speak our own language, which is Karam language.
But recreating the past for the tourists' quest for the authentic is helping them to preserve their culture and language.
The young generation coming up lose their dialect now. They only speak Pidgin English. That's one of the areas where these villages are now failing. So we are trying our best to, you know, restart the tradition before the old people pass away.
Luckily, one tradition that's not coming back, as I note the plump weight of visiting tourists, is cannibalism. Lots of visitors want to hear about cannibals, but the practice stopped in the 1930s.
Well, I gave her a low price so she could come up a little bit.
I wonder if us tourists have become the cannibals.
Because you generally bargain.
Women have lined up souvenirs along the path back to the boat. Even a living museum exits through a gift shop.
They dropped down to 20.
In a globalized world, it is culture that is commodified and consumed.
She dropped down to 20?
Yeah.
We travel further upriver to another village and, like everywhere, we're greeted by excited children. As part of our tour, an elder demonstrates how to peel bark off a log. A woman cooks over an open fire. A canoe is being chopped into shape.
The white people came in like first missionaries. They came in for first contact and start tell them, wear these clothes.
This is Paul, a guide with the Kirawari Lodge. He's talking about Western clothes, which I don't see anyone wearing. No t-shirts or shorts, just grass skirts, bare breasts, skimpy loincloths, and naked children.
People who are in Western clothes are not allowed to get close to those people who are dressed up in their local dressings because they are with the tourists taking pictures.
Every tourist has a camera. We take images, cannibalize a moment in light. We often confuse authentic with poverty, past with present.
Tourists are taking pictures. They don't want to take pictures of those wearing Western clothes.
It's the 21st century, but while visiting a traditional village, I'm being pulled forward into the past. I'm visiting a time that the villagers themselves never even experienced.
This is our own lifestyle in the past.
I asked Paul if the village wants to live in the past.
People dress up here? Do they want to go back?
No.
So why do
it's too far now. They can't go back, you know, traditional dressings now because they are now influencing the Western culture now.
So when white men first came up the river, they told the native people to put on clothes, stop speaking the local language, abandon their traditional ways, and here's a Bible. Now white people come and say, take off your Western clothes, embrace and display your traditional ways, but keep the Bible.
My name is Jackson Pinier. Our ancestors were cannibals. That's why they hunt the indigenous group of people to eat.
Jackson and his band are performing at the Kokopo Lodge for us white folk, bringing us closer to the present with a song about my lost tribe, Californians. In the quest for the real, the authentic, I finally arrived in the present while seeking shelter from a rainstorm in a schoolhouse. On the Duke of York Island, the children, most in shorts, some in t-shirts, the girls in Western dresses, sing a song for me, one they all know, the Papua New Guinea national anthem. I'm Jake Warga for Travel with Rick Steves.
Jake Warga is a freelance public radio producer, photographer, travel guide, and teacher. He divides his time between Seattle and Morocco. You can listen to his guest appearances on Travel with Rick Steves in our show archives. Look for programs number 348 and 357. He'll be back on the show from time to time to take us with him in his amazing travels. Jake has also put together a video presentation to go with his feature on Papua New Guinea. You can see that via this week's show details, and that's in the radio section of ricksteves.com. Let's continue our voyage into the far reaches of the South Seas and head next into the wide expanse of the tropical Pacific. Author J. Martin Truce joins us in a minute to tell us what he and his wife found when they moved to a tiny atoll in Micronesia. The author of Headhunters on My Doorstep joins us next on Travel with Rick Steves.